Hello, good evening, and welcome to Seascapes. On tonight's programme, we're on a pilot boat in the Shannon Estuary, and we hear about U-boat commanders in World War II. Pilot boats and the pilot service are a little-known but vital component in every port. They guide large ships onto their berths, and shipping all over the world would grind to a halt without them. Lorna Siggins has been speaking to pilots on the west coast of Ireland.
Without them, everything would stop. They really are a national asset. Those were the words of Port of Galway Harbourmaster Captain Brian Sheridan recently. And who was he talking about? Well, port pilots, of course. Those people who play an unsung, vital role in ensuring that key supply lines are kept open during this pandemic. Patrick Galvin, chairman of the Association of Marine Pilots of Ireland, couldn't disagree. From the Shannon Estuary, he's well used to having to explain to people that no, his job has nothing to do with flying. Recently, he spoke to Seascapes from the bridge of a ship he was piloting out of Foynes about his work. But first, he introduced me to the captain of the 90-metre cargo vessel Minka Sea, ZB Fisher.
My name is Zbigniew Fisher. I'm Polish. The name of the ship is Minka Sea. I'm already 4 months on this ship. It's a normal coaster, two hold with maximum cargo. We can take around 5,300 tons. Maximum draft is 6.2 meters. So with some trim, it's 6.7. It's convenient draft for many ports. I have experience around 35 years at sea. Long time ago, we have to be on the ships without any communication with family, sometimes 6 months around the globe. The new generation have problem because, they have permanent contact with the internet, telephone. But every company, including our company, make some effort for the crew. Then we have extra money for satellite communication with family without any payment. Then we reduced contact with the, not we reduced, everyone reducing contact with the ships. I joking, the most danger for us is the pilot. We have to manage together, keep clever in this situation. Since about 3.5 months, we not allowed to go any ports ashore. This is strange, but what to do? Have no choice.
Pilot Patrick Galvin took Captain Fisher's teasing in good stead.
So the ship was after discharging his cargo fertilizer there in Foynes. He has no orders now, so he's heading back out to sea. So what I do is when I get on the ship, I speak to the captain about the maneuvering characteristics of the vessel, what way the tide is and the wind, and then we come up with a plan for unberthing the ship. What I would do is I'd look at the passage plan of the vessel just to see if his courses are right for going down the river, make any minor adjustments. Usually there's none to be made. All the guys are pretty professional. So the ship would have then a couple of radars. This particular ship's very well equipped. It has electronic chart systems as well. Yeah, I never sailed on the ship as an officer with electronic charts. So yeah, it was only paper charts when I was at sea. And it's obviously I look out the window. That's part of, well, most of my job. It's getting visual cues. So for every course I would go on to, I would have something to line up onto. I might line up a chimneys in Money Point with a castle or something, and then I will know exactly if I'm clearing banks and things like that. Also, I would use the radar and the electronic chart. So it's using whatever means I have available to me to figure out where I am in the river and where I need to be going. And obviously the ship's compass as well for course.
Earlier, Patrick had told me how he was attracted to the job and where he trained.
I'm from a small village called Kappa, just outside Kilrush in County Clare. It's on the northern bank of the Shannon Estuary with some beautiful views of the very scenic Scattery and Hog Islands. My grandfather and uncle were pilots. I also had some relations that were pilots as well. So the house I grew up in, there was always talks of ship movements on the river, life at sea, what cargoes these ships were carrying, like where they came from, where they were going, and it always piqued my interest. And then I suppose as a young lad I would have done the occasional trip on the river accompanying
pilots, just to see what the job itself was like. So from that experience, then I realized what I wanted to do as a career was become a pilot on the Shannon Estuary. To become a pilot, really, you have to get a Master Mariner's license. That requires a lot of time in college, plenty of time studying. Also requires you to go to sea for a number of years. So when I completed the Leaving Cert in 1993, I ended up working for Arklow Shipping, laterally then moving on to P&O Ferries and then Stena Line. I finished off working for Stena Line under Dublin to Holyhead route as captain. Then in 2009, a vacancy arose on the Shannon Estuary as a pilot. So I've been here ever since and loved every minute of it. It's a very rewarding and fulfilling job. There are between 45 to 50 pilots between all Irish ports. I'm chairman of the Association of Marine Pilots of Ireland. We're the professional body for pilots in Ireland. At present, we don't have any women pilots in Ireland. I suppose historically speaking, throughout the centuries, life at sea has been a male-dominated career. You're looking at, we'll say, shipping companies now, they're offering much better work rotations. The advent of the internet and mobile phones, it's made communications with home a lot simpler. So since 2009, since I've become a pilot, I'm starting to see more and more female officers and the occasional female captain. So as vacancies arise in Irish ports as pilots in the future, I would hope to see sooner rather than later, Ireland's first female marine pilot. I'm looking out the bridge now and on the port side, we're just after leaving the berth here in Ochonish, and I'm looking out onto Foynes Island, and hidden behind the island is the port of Foynes. It's a busy port for us actually. It can handle ships up to 10.5 meters draft, 200 meters in length, can cater for many cargoes like coal, oils, acids, grains. That they'd be kind of the main cargoes we get going in and out of there. The village of Foynes itself, it's a beautiful village, and I suppose has a historically relevant maritime and flying boat museum there, which is well worth a visit. Yeah, I spent a lot of time looking out the bridge windows, actually. It's I'd use a lot of visual cues, as in I would line up a headland with, we'll say, a Tarbert Chimneys, and I know that would clear me off a certain rock. These visual cues help me know where I am on the river and where I need to be going. I would also, of course, be looking at the ship's instrumentation, as in its radars, its depth sounders, its chart systems. On a whole, our job is it's quite safe, really, but with one dangerous aspect, and that is getting on and off ships. And for anybody who doesn't know, a pilot ladder is a ladder constructed out of timber and rope. Obviously, climbing these ladders can be dangerous. It was only today I found out of one of our colleagues in South Africa. He was halfway up the ladder and the ropes parted. The pilot fell to the water, and luckily he was recovered relatively quickly and suffered only some minor symptoms of hypothermia. Last December, one of our colleagues in New York, a Captain Dennis Sherwood, fell from a pilot ladder while boarding a container ship inbound to New York, and unfortunately he lost his life. So that aspect of our job is quite dangerous. 90% of all goods coming in and out of Ireland are handled by the ports. They're the lifeblood of the country. Falling ill is a normal part of everyday life. If a group of us fell ill, that's a problem. So we have established in all ports now, working with the harbour masters and working with port health, we've established methods of work where the pilots don't meet each other. So I haven't seen my colleagues on the Shannon here for a number of weeks now. So if one of us fell ill, even with the coronavirus, we have ensured that I'm not going to infect my other colleagues, thereby not disrupting the supply chain.
But back to the Minka Sea. And Patrick told me what course he was on with Captain Fisher.
I'm on a course of 242, just right abeam of Village of Glen, looking out on Glen Castle, heading down towards Tarbert. We have southwest wind of about 15 knots, and it's a beautiful sunny day, actually. Us as pilots, we have sort of a unique program going with the local Irish Whale and Dolphin Group. They have been monitoring the dolphins on the river since about 1992 and have recorded up to about 140 individual dolphins that would use the estuary. They're not absolutely resident here because they have been found down off Brandon and up towards the Aran Islands and Galway and that as well. But they chase food, so in the winter time when there's no salmon running here, you might not see them for a few weeks or maybe even a month or two. us pilots, we would log the dolphin, and then that gives extra data that the Irish whale and dolphin group would have not had before. This far up the river, I've never seen whales or anything like that. Once I saw an albino seal, which was, that was probably the most unusual piece of wildlife I saw. Yeah, what I'm doing now, it's basically, it's monitoring tides the whole time and wind and traffic movements. Right now we're coming down towards Tarbert. There's a ferry crossing there every half an hour, so obviously I'm going to have to report into it in a moment.
Shannon Breeze, make a see, then be out. Good job, thanks, Neil.
Yeah, that's the Kilimer Tarbert ferry. New faces every trip. I've met this captain before, but I think we've nailed it down to January 2018. It's been quite a while ago, but more or less every ship I get on, it's a new face, new crew. And very often we don't have ships coming into the Shannon like you would do in Dublin, like the ferries back and forth every day. So more or less every time it's a new ship I've been on as well, you know, or at least it's been a few years since I've been on it. So every day is a new day, thankfully.
Shannon Breeze, make the sea that's all topic. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks to Lorna Siggins. Sky Atlantic just this week made available the second series of Das Boot, the World War II drama about U-boats. It's loosely based on the concept of the original series from the 1970s and is in German, English and French. It's a series which has been hugely popular in many countries. Jeremy Dixon is the author of a book, The U-Boat Commanders, a history of many of the captains of the U-boats. I spoke to him earlier. I asked him who these people were. Most of them were not Nazis.
More than anything, they were in it for the do their duty, very much behind their commander, Dönitz, who in fact, ironically enough, was a true Nazi. And I think in Das Boot they had a political officer on board, which they didn't always. I think that was done for the film.
Tell me something about the commanders. Who were they in general?
Gunther Prein, for example, he was the first U-boat commander to win the Knight's Cross. And he had one of the first big successes. He was commander of U-47, and he was the man who sunk the Royal Oak at Scarpa Flow in October 39. I mean, that killed 835 naval personnel. And the British were very shocked by this because they didn't think anybody would get into Scarpa Flow. They thought it was almost impregnable. But Prine managed to get in, sink this ship, and then sneak out again. But it did do a lot to affect the morale of the Britain at the time, because we weren't expected to lose something that large.
What was the background of these men?
They were quite young men that joined the Navy at the start or before World War II. There wasn't very many that fought in World War I. They were extremely brave people. I mean, the little tiny U-boats.
They had a very high mortality rate in that whole service.
Oh, they did. The Germans lost an awful lot of U-boats. They built almost 1,200 or just under 1,200. I mean, they lost almost 800, either surrendered or destroyed. 600 of those were sunk by Allied shipping or from the air.
They also had their most successful times very early in the war. The tide turned maybe end of 1941, 1942.
The main thing was the person who really believed in U-boats was Dönitz himself, but Hitler didn't. And the head of the Navy at the time, before Dönitz took over, was a man called Admiral Rader. And he didn't believe in U-boats either. He believed in the big battleships, as Hitler did, because Hitler felt that the bigger the battleship, this portrays a strong Third Reich, and he wanted these great big ships built. In fact, he had four huge ones built, and he lost all of them. But it wasn't until quite late that they started to build the U-boats that Dönitz wanted, but they just came too late. They'd run out of top commanders. A lot of commanders had been killed. And yes, it just came too late. I mean, Hitler didn't listen to anybody, basically. He had his own agenda.
When they went on patrol, how long would they spend at sea?
Oh, it would be sometime months. One of the commanders, he actually went to the New York Harbour just to prove a point that he could get there.
Who then were the most successful commanders?
Wolfgang Luff, and he sank just over 225,000 tons of ships.
Which is 46 ships.
And he had quite a, I mean, he did all of that, but he had quite a bizarre ending towards the end of the war, wasn't a U-boat commander anymore. He became an adjutant to Dönitz and was later made commander of the naval school at Flensburg. But on the night of the 13th and 14th of May 1945, when Germany had actually surrendered, but they still had a government under Dönitz, he was killed. He was walking back, probably drunk, from Dönitz's headquarters. He was going towards the naval school, and it was very dark and rainy, and the young sentries were very jumpy at that time. They didn't know what was going to happen. The war was over, basically, but they didn't know what the Allies were going to do with them. Luff himself had ordered them to shoot on sight if nobody answered their challenges. And basically, that's what happened. He was shouted at twice. They didn't recognise him, and they shot him. And he was given a Nazi state funeral, which was the last one ever given on the 16th of May. So he survived all of that in his U-boat and was killed by his own people at the end.
And then you have the most successful person in Otto Kretschmar. He was taken prisoner in 1941, but in fact, by that time, had sunk 47 ships.
He had. He backed almost 275,000 tons. I mean, I think he survived the war probably because he was captured, but he went on to be a high-ranking admiral in the Bundesmarine after the war. So
and also in the NATO, he became the chief of staff of the NATO command.
Yes, he did extremely well, and he was a great voice. I mean, he was interviewed so many times on World at War and things like that. Yes, he was. I think he worked with, still kept in contact with Dönitz after the war. I think he died about 1998, I believe.
He did die in 1998, yeah. And then the third person you have is a man called Erich Topp. He sunk 35 ships. And he also survived the war.
Yes, so he did a great. I mean, I used to go to military fairs in the 80s and 90s, and you always see Kretschmar and Topp's photographs signed, people selling. I think they were all, what I said about them not being Nazis, I think that was one of the reasons. They were thought to have been just commanders without being Nazis. Does that make sense?
Tell me something about Friedrich Guttenberger.
Right. Well, he won the Knight's Cross with Oak Leafs, and he was responsible for sinking the Ark Royal, which was the an aircraft carrier. It was the third largest ship that was sunk during the war, third largest British ship, sunk in November 1941. Yeah, it was in the Mediterranean. It was under tow at the time. It was hit by one torpedo, and it had almost 1,500 men on board, but only miraculously, only one man was killed. I think it sunk so slowly they managed to get everybody off.
One thing that struck me about these very successful commanders, quite a high proportion of them survived the war.
I mean, there were others that didn't win the Knight's Cross that weren't so lucky. But I think the thing was, you're put on almost a pedestal and taken out of frontline action. They did that with fighter pilots as well, because they didn't want to lose the expertise of these men. And, of course, it was a great propaganda having these men being so successful. Knight's Cross winners were often, photographs were taken and made into postcards and sold. And I think that's what happened. I think they took these successful people off the front line, so to speak, and put them into training other U-boat commanders. A lot of them survived because they were taken off the front line duty before it got really, really bad.
And Jeremy Dixon's book, The U-Boat Commanders, is published by Pen and Sword Books in the UK. You'll find it on Kindle. And the series of Das Boot is available on Sky Atlantic. Going back a little bit earlier, most ports and harbours in Ireland had their own shipping company or companies which had run for years. A regular contributor, Hugh Orme, has been looking back at some iconic ship lines which ran only in Ireland.
One feature of the Irish shipping industry that's long since disappeared is the vast number of coastal trading vessels, so many that practically every coastal city and town throughout Ireland had its own shipping line. Perhaps the most typical of these locally based shipping companies was the Waterford Steamship Company, founded by Joseph Malcolmson in 1836. In those far-off days, ships' hulls were built from wood and they depended on sails for their motive power. The company in Waterford had a dozen ships in its fleet, later converted to steamers, that ran frequent services between Bristol, Liverpool and ports here in Ireland. The company traded successfully until 1870, when its services between Waterford and London were taken over by the B&I Steam Packet Company. A further takeover came in 1912, when the Waterford firm was bought by the Clyde Shipping Company, and it eventually disappeared altogether from the shipping scene. Many other local steamship companies survived into the early 20th century, but by a century ago, the predominant aspect of this part of the shipping business was the winding up of these companies, as they were overtaken by technological advances and the operations of much larger shipping companies. In Dublin, one of the main companies was the British and Irish Steam Packet Company, later known simply as the B&I Line, which started in Dublin Port with a fleet of wooden paddle steamers in 1836. But sadly, it was unable to survive all the technical and commercial challenges of the later 20th century, and by 1995 it was defunct. Another Dublin company that was once very well known was the City of Dublin Steam Packet Company, set up in 1823, 13 years earlier than its longtime rival, the British and Irish Steam Packet Company. The City of Dublin Company had many cross-channel routes which it ran for nearly a century. And one of the very lucrative contracts it had for 70 of the years it traded was mail traffic, transporting letters and parcels from Ireland to Britain and vice versa. It was wound up in 1922, just as the new Irish Free State was coming into existence. To the north of Dublin, Dundalk had its very own steam packet company for many years during the 19th century, but in 1871 it amalgamated with the Newry Steam Packet Company. Then, 45 years later, in 1926, this company was taken over by the B&I Line. Rather amazingly, and against all the odds, the company managed to maintain services between Liverpool and Dundalk and Newry until 1968. One of the services that ran out of Drogheda between 1876 and 1902 was a regular passenger service between Drogheda and Glasgow. At the other end of the country, in Cork, there was also a proud tradition of locally owned and run shipping companies. The St. George Steamship Company was founded in the early 19th century by Joseph Pym, but by 1843 this company had run into severe difficulties and was reorganised into the City of Cork Steamship Company. And by the 1870s, the Cork Company had expanded so much that the operation was split into two separate companies, the City of Cork Steam Packet Company for coastal routes and the Cork Steamship Company, which operated continental and other foreign routes out of Liverpool. Another local shipping company in County Cork was the Bantry Bay Steamship Company, which traded between 1883 and 1946. It was a small operation carrying about 25 tons of cargo a month from the mainland to Bere Island. It managed to keep going until just after the end of the Second World War emergency. Perhaps the main factor in killing off the thriving steam packet trade in the latter 19th century was the arrival of the railways from the 1840s onwards. Emigrants who had often previously travelled from their homes to the nearest ports around the country started using the newly arrived railways to take the train to Dublin, where there was a much better selection of shipping services, both cross-channel and to America. In truth, the local steam packet companies in Ireland, with their wooden ships and sail power, once held powerful sway over shipping routes from many local ports around the whole coast of Ireland. There was hardly a town on the entire Irish coastline that didn't have its own steam packet company, from Wexford in the southeast to Derry in the northwest. But the speed of technological change in the shipping business meant that many of these local shipping companies were wiped out at remarkable speed, and in the process they became a mere footnote in the eternally fascinating history of shipping in Ireland.
Hugh Oram. And that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're back at the same time next Friday. Everything on the programme's podcast is on our website, rte.ie/seascapes. If you want to contact the programme, our email is seascapes@rte.ie. Let's hope we're all back on the water very soon, and if you are, stay safe.